The lash of the Mauser cracked again, and at the shock, Mark Ander's eyelids blinked twice very quickly and then flared wide open. The golden brown eyes stared fixedly up at the slope, intent as those of the hunting peregrine. The instant after the shot, he heard the rattle of the Mauser bolt being drawn back and then thrust forward to reload, and again the tip of the Hessian rat muzzle stirred slightly. But then Mark's eyes flicked sideways. There had been another movement, so fine that it might have gone unnoticed by eyes less keen. The movement had been a mere breath, and it had been in the narrow 3-inch gap between the oak trunk and the snow-coated earth. Just that one brief stir, and then stillness once more. Mark stared into the gap for long seconds and saw nothing, merely shadow and undefined shape, trickily reflected light from the snow beyond. Then suddenly he was seeing something else. It was the texture of cloth, a thin sliver of it in the narrow gap. Then his eyes picked up the stitched seam in the grey cloth, bulging slightly over the living flesh beneath. There was some small portion of the German's body showing through the gap. He was lying close up on the far side of the log, and his head was pointed in the direction from which the muzzle of the Mauser projected. Carefully, Mark proportioned the man's body in his imagination, using the rifle muzzle as his only reference point. He placed the man's head and shoulders, his trunk and his hips. Yes, his hips, Mark thought. That is his hip, or upper thigh. And then there was a change in the light. The sun found a weak spot in the cloud cover overhead, and the light brightened briefly. In the better light, Mark made out a small portion of a German service belt, with the empty loop, which should have held a bayonet. It confirmed his guess. Now he knew that the slight bulge in the field grey material was caused by the head of the femur, where it fitted into the cup of the pelvic girdle. Through both hips, Mark thought coldly. It's a pinning shot. And then there is the femoral artery. Carefully, he began to work the glove off his right hand. He must roll on his side and swing the long barrel of the P-14 through an arc of over 90 degrees without making the least sound. Please God, Mark asked silently, and began to make the move. Achingly slowly, the barrel of his rifle swung, and at the same time he began to transfer his weight onto his other elbow. It seemed to be a complete round of eternity before the P-14 pointed into the narrow gap below the oak trunk, and Mark was doubled up, straining to keep the barrel bearing from this unnatural position. He could not slip the safety catch from the rifle before firing. Even that tiny metallic snick would alert the German. He curled his finger on the trigger and took up the pull, feeling the dead lock of the safety mechanism. He aimed carefully, his head twisted awkwardly, and he began to push the safety catch across with his thumb, while holding pressure on the hair trigger. It had to be done smoothly so as not to pull his aim off the sliver of grey uniform cloth. The thunder of the shot seemed to bounce against the low grey sky, and the bullet crashed through the tiny gap. Mark saw the impact of it, the rubbery shock of metal into flesh. He heard the German cry out, a wild sound without form or meaning, and Mark swept back the bolt of the P-14 and reloaded with instinctive dexterity. The next shot blended with the echo of the first, coming so close together that they seemed as one. The jacketed bullet crashed through the gap, and this time Mark saw blood spurt, a bright scarlet spray of it that splattered the snow, turning swiftly to pale pink as it was diluted by the melt of its own heat. Then there was nothing in the gap. The German had been thrown back by the impact, or had rolled aside. Only the smear of pink-stained snow. Mark waited, a fresh cartridge in the breech of the P-14, turned now to face the oak trunk, tensed for the next shot. If it had not been a decisive wound, the German would be coming after him, and he was ready for the snapshot. He felt coldly unemotional, but vitally aware. His every fibre and nerve pitched to its utmost, his vision sharp and bright, and his hearing enhanced. The silence drew out for a while longer, and then there was a sound. For a moment, Mark did not recognize it. Then it came again, the sound of a man sobbing. It came stronger now, more hysterical, gut-racking.
Ach, mein Gott, mein lieber Gott!
The man's voice, pitiful, broke.
Das Blut, ach Gott, das Blut!
Suddenly the sound was tearing at Mark's soul, cutting deeply into his being. His hand began to shake, and he felt the tremor of his lips once again. He tried to clench his jaw, but now his teeth were chattering wildly.
Stop it, oh God, stop it,
he whispered, and the rifle fell from his hands. He pressed his mittened hands to his ears, trying to shut out the terrible sounds of the dying German.
Please, please, Mark pleaded aloud, stop it, please.
And the German seemed to hear him.
Hilf mir, lieber Gott, das Blut.
His voice was broken by the wet, helpless sounds of his despair. Suddenly, Mark was crawling forward through the snow, blindly up the slope.
I'm coming. It's all right, he muttered. Only stop it.
He felt his senses swaying.
Ach, mein lieber Gott! Ach, meine Mutti! Oh, Jesus, stop it, stop it!
Mark dragged himself around the end of the oak log. The German was half propped against the log. With both hands, he was trying vainly to stem the fountain of bright, pulsing arterial blood that flowed through his fumbling fingers. The two bullets had shattered both his hips, and the snow was a sodden, mushy porridge of blood. He turned his face to Mark, and already it was drained of all colour, a shiny greyish-white, slick with a fine sheen of perspiration. The German was young as Mark, but swiftly approaching death had smoothed out his features so he seemed younger still. It was the face of a marble angel, smooth and white and strangely beautiful, with blue eyes in pale blue sockets, a burst of pale golden curls escaping from under the helmet onto the smooth pale forehead. He opened his mouth and said something that Mark did not understand, and the teeth were white and even beyond the full pale lips. Then, slowly, the German sagged back against the log, still staring at Mark. His hands fell away from his groin, and the regular pulsing spurt of blood from the shattered flesh slowed and shriveled away. The pale blue eyes lost their feverish luster and dulled, no longer focused. Mark felt a thread pull in the fabric of his mind, like silk beginning to tear. It was almost a physical thing. He could hear it beginning to give way inside him. His vision wavered. The dead German's features seemed to run like melting wax, and then slowly reformed again. Mark felt the tear widening, the silken veil of his reason ripping through. Beyond it was a dark and echoing chasm. The dead German's features went on reforming, until they hardened, and Mark was looking into his own face as through a wavering, distorted mirror. His own haunted face, the eyes golden brown and terrified, the mouth that was his mouth opened, and a cry came from it that was the despair and the agony of all the world. The last shreds of Mark's reason whipped away on the tempest of horror, and he heard himself screaming, and felt his feet running under him, and there was only blackness in his head, and his body was light and without weight, like the body of a bird in flight. The German machine gunner cocked the Maxim with a single savage wrench on the crank handle and traversed sharply left, at the same time depressing the thick water-jacketed barrel of the weapon until it pointed directly down the slope below the sandbagged emplacement towards the British lines. The single wildly running figure was angling away towards the left, and the gunner pulled the wooden butt of the Maxim into his shoulder and fired a single shot traversing burst, aiming a fraction low to counteract the natural tendency to shoot high at a downhill target. Mark Anders hardly felt the mighty hammer strokes of the two bullets that smashed into his back. Fergus MacDonald was crying. That surprised Sean. He had not expected it. The tears slid slowly from pink-rimmed eyes, and he struck them away with a single angry movement.
"Permission to take out a patrol, sir?" he asked.
And the young captain glanced uncertainly at Sean over the sergeant's shoulder. Sean nodded slightly, a mere inclination of the head.
Do you think you can find volunteers? The captain asked uncertainly. And the red-faced sergeant answered gruffly, There'll be volunteers, sir. The lads have a feeling for what that youngster did. Very well, then. As soon as it's dark.
They found Mark a little after 8 o'clock. He hung in the rusting barbed wire at the bottom of the slope, like a broken doll. Fergus MacDonald had to use a pair of wire cutters to cut him down, and it took them nearly another hour to get him back to the British lines, dragging the stretcher between them through the mud and slushy snow.
He's dead, said General Courtney, looking down at the white, drained face on the stretcher in the lantern light. No, he's not, Fergus MacDonald denied it fiercely. They don't kill my boy that easy.
The locomotive whistled shrilly as it clattered over the steelwork of the bridge. Silver steam flew high in bright plume and then smeared back on the wind. Mark Anders leaned far out over the balcony of the single passenger carriage, and the same wind ruffled the soft brown wing of his hair, and a spattering of ash particles from the furnace stung his cheek. But he screwed up his eyes and looked down into the bed of the river as they roared across. The water flowed down under the dipping reeds, and then met the pylons of the bridge and swirled sullenly, flowing green and strong and full down to the sea.
"Water's high for this time of year," Mark muttered aloud. "Grandpapa will be happy."
And he felt his lips tugging up into the unaccustomed smile. He had smiled only infrequently during the past months. The locomotive hurtled across the steel bridge and threw itself at the far slope. Immediately the beat of its engine changed and its speed bled away. Mark stooped and hefted his old military pack, opened the gate of the balcony and clambered down onto the steel steps, hanging with one arm over the racing gravel embankment. The train slowed rapidly as the incline steepened, and he swung the pack off his shoulder and leaned far out to let it drop as gently as possible onto the gravel. It bounced once and went bounding away down the embankment, crashing into the shrubbery like a living animal in flight. Then he swung down towards the racing earth himself, and judging his moment finely as the train crested the ridge, he let go to hit the embankment on flying feet, throwing his weight forward to ride the impact and feel the gravel sliding under him. He stayed upright and came to a halt as the rest of the train clattered past him, and the guard looked out sternly from the last van and called a reprimand.
"Hey, that's against the law!"
"Send the sheriff,"
Mark shouted back, and gave him an ironic salute as the locomotive picked up speed on the reverse slope with explosive grunts of power, the rhythm of the tracks rising sharply. The guard clenched a fist, and Mark turned away. The jolt had hurt his back again, and he slipped a hand into his shirt and ran it around under his armpit as he started back along the tracks. He fingered the twin depressions below the shoulder blade and marvelled again at how close one of them was to the bony projections of the spine. The scar tissue had a silky, almost sensuous feel, but they had taken long months to close. Mark shuddered involuntarily as he remembered the rattle of the trolley that carried the dressings and the impassive, almost masculine face of the matron as she stuffed the long cotton plugs into the open mouths of the bullet wounds. He remembered also the slow, tearing agony as the bloody dressing was pulled out again, and the glittering steel forceps, and his own breathing sobbing in his ears, and the matron's voice harsh and impersonal.
"Oh, don't be a baby!"
Every day, day after day, week after week, until the hot, feverish delirium of the pneumonia that had attacked his bullet-damaged lung had seemed a blessed relief. How long had it been? From the VAD station in a French field, with the muddy snow deeply rutted by the ambulances and the burial details digging graves beyond the tented hospital, to the general hospital near Brighton, and the dark mists of pneumonia, the hospital ship home down the length of the Atlantic, baking in the airless tropics, the convalescent hospital with its pleasant lawns and gardens. How long? 14 months in all. Months during which the war, which men were already misnaming great, had ended. Pain and delirium had clouded the passage of time. Yet it seemed a whole lifetime.